From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on Tuesday evening when a 21-year-old gunman opened fire at three different spas in Atlanta. The man killed eight people, and six were women of Asian descent. Investigators are still trying to ascertain a motive, but some are already saying that this is an attack that is the latest in a recent wave of hate crimes and violence against Asian Americans, many of which have been tied to discrimination related to the pandemic. Many Asian Americans have said they are living in fear during this time. Some are afraid to leave their homes. What can fellow Americans do to help support Asian and Asian American communities? It's a question that will be addressed at an upcoming three-part series led by the Jewish Federation's Levine Center to End Hate and Monroe Community College's Department of Global Education and International Services. The series is called Asian Matters, Standing with Rochester's Asian American Communities, and it will explore the Asian and Asian American communities of Greater Rochester, the history of racism and xenophobia aimed at those communities in the United States, and ways we can work together to support our Asian and Asian American neighbors. The conference was scheduled prior to the tragedies in Georgia this week, but that violence will now be discussed as part of the event, of course. And there's a lot to talk about this hour. Our guests will answer your questions as well. I will welcome them now. Karen Elam is director of the Levine Center to End Hate at the Jewish Federation of Greater Rochester. Karen, welcome. Nice having you on the program.
Thank you, Evan.
Natasha Chen Christensen is an associate professor of sociology at Monroe Community College. Natasha, welcome.
Thank you, Evan.
Christina Lee is coordinator for global education at Monroe Community College. Welcome, Christina.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for having us.
And Pilapa Isara Carroll. Dr. Carroll is an associate professor in the Department of Anthropology at SUNY Brockport. Dr. Carroll, welcome. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Karen, let me just start with you. And you know, listeners might assume that this is all coming together because of what happened in Atlanta this week, but that's not necessarily the case. Tell me what's going on.
That's right. Thanks, Evan. And can you hear me okay?
I can, yep.
Okay, terrific. So that's right. What happened is that as we noticed the reports coming out about the increased attacks and violence directed at Asians and Asian Americans, Pacific Islanders across the country, we wanted to put something together to bring attention to that issue. And so Christina, as you mentioned, is part of our steering committee, and we began conversations and were able to invite your other two wonderful guests to kick us off this Sunday, talking about the history of racism and xenophobia aimed at Asians and Asian Americans in our country, and, you know, also giving us some foundation on who is in this community of Rochester that is part of the Asian and Pacific Islander community. So you're right. It didn't start with what happened Tuesday. Sadly, what happened Tuesday just amplified the importance of the program.
How do people participate if they'd like to?
So they should go to our website. It's endhateroc.org. It's right on the front page. Just scroll down and click on the link and register. It's free. It's Zoom, 5:30 this Sunday, and then that will be followed by two more sessions, one on Sunday, April 11th, and then Sunday, May 2nd. It's all there on the website, and we really welcome as many people in the community to join us. There's no limit on numbers. It's a webinar. So, yeah, really encourage people to join the program.
Let me ask Dr. Natasha Chen Christensen first here, as we look at what happened in Atlanta. Dr. Christensen, I think it's important for journalists to try to be fully accurate in how we report on anything, to state the obvious, but particularly when communities are feeling fear. And what I mean by that is, you know, we are still formally waiting for a determination of motive. There have been some denials that this was racially based or et cetera. It's hard not to see the pattern. But at the same time, I am very much aware that there are some Asian Americans who have felt discriminated against or worried or concerned in various ways over the last year. How do we square the anxiety that a community feels with making sure that we are reporting accurately about threats, that we're not overhyping, but we are direct about what people are experiencing, because based on what I've seen, there have been an increase in numbers, not just in Atlanta, but over the last year, whether it's discrimination-based incidents, harassment, physical attacks, et cetera. What's the picture that you see?
Yes, there's definitely been an increase in these incidents, and it does come about from the narrative that's been communicated to the U.S. about the pandemic that we're facing right now. Asian Americans have always been a convenient scapegoat for these type of issues, and what we find is that throughout American history, the American federal government actually has kind of wielded policies, right, to bring groups over, you know, to work for America, and then at the same time, then kind of set them apart and then, you know, kind of highlight them as part of our society's social problems. So it was the association then in the press and from the federal government, I think, that kind of instigated a lot of this hostility right now. What's troubling about how the incident in Atlanta is being reported is that I've seen multiple reports where they're asserting that it is not race-based violence, and instead then arguing that it is something having to do with sexual addiction and this and the murderer's kind of fantasy life. And that is actually an incorrect portrayal, because what we're looking at right now is the intersection of multiple identities, and that would be the Asian American identity, but also Asian American women specifically. And so these attacks then are related in kind of a broader sense, because I feel that due to these messages in the media and from the federal government, that we are kind of looking at people who are emboldened to actually give voice and give action to the prejudice that they held beforehand.
Can you elaborate a little bit on the notion of scapegoating? I mean, certainly our listeners can quickly understand that in the last year, that has been sort of a result of a pandemic in which you had a virus that, you know, seemed to originate in China, but was labeled by the president of the United States, the China virus, in ways that were not just about trying to be helpful. I guess what I'm trying to say in the last year, Dr. Christensen, is it's one thing to say, hey, we've got this variant, and we're going to call this variant the UK variant or the New York City variant or the South Africa variant, because we want to be specific on where it was first discovered so we can track it. It's another to say this is the China virus, the China virus, the China virus, as a way of sort of intentionally inflicting some sort of blame or, you know, sort of a pejorative term to it. Do you see a distinction there as I do?
Yes, actually, I do, especially since, you know, the origins, and they are, you know, the news out there is saying that the origins of the virus in the United States actually primarily came from European travel, not from Asian travel. Mm-hmm. And what happens in terms of scapegoating is that you take a group that has very little power. And basically, in the United States, you're looking at Asian Americans being a small minority. We're 6% of the U.S. population. We're easily identifiable. And rather than kind of go into the complexities of the larger issue, it's very easy to distill a very simple message in that case, right? Targeting certain groups for the problems of an entire society.
And the last 12 months, unfortunately, are not the only occasion in history. Do you think that we've got a pretty good handle, or I assume series like this are designed to make sure the American public does understand a history of scapegoating, Dr. Christensen?
Actually, so Chinese Americans were actually the first group of people who were banned to immigrate to the United States on the basis of their origin. And that actually came up after America used Chinese labor to basically connect the east part of the U.S. United States to the west side of the United States in terms of building the railroads. After that labor was done, then it was very easy to take that same group that built those railroads, that created the infrastructure, and then actually blame them for stealing the jobs that should have gone to white Americans, for causing increases in crime that actually were not necessarily related to them. And it is something that we've actually seen in U.S. history before.
Christina Lee, can I ask you to just offer some thoughts about your reaction to what we saw in Atlanta and maybe the broader context of what it means of what's happening in this country right now?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, certainly this week has been alarming for many of us. I think not just Asians and Asian Americans, but all of us collectively, I think, as a country. You know, I'm really glad that we planned this series ahead of what happened this week, because the acceleration of incidents to Asian and Asian Americans have increased this last 12 months. But this kind of discrimination isn't new. Just like Dr. Christensen said, it's something that many of us experience personally, that we've seen systemically, institutionally over, you know, the past 100 years. But I think, unfortunately, we're at a place in our history where this kind of racially motivated attacks, unfortunately, are more common right now.
Do you feel that the sort of the unfortunately the culture wars, you know, it's almost like instantly an event like this will happen, and there is a, it's like a knee jerk denial in some quarters that, well, this isn't, you know, you can't tie this to one thing, or, you know, sort of denying that there's any sort of a trend or concern that would be legitimated in any sense here. And I don't really know what to do with that, you know, Christina. It feels that things are so strangely intractable, and even, you know, just horrifying events and tragedies like we saw in Atlanta don't always spur solidarity and reaction, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I hear you. I think, you know, those of us, I think, who have studied this issue over time and across history in this country, I think it's not a new issue for us. Perhaps it is for others. I'm hoping that this series of discussions and talks will highlight some new things for all of us. You know, we certainly are all... we all have different kinds of information on these issues. I hope that people will listen and be will have an open mind to think about how this incident this week can be connected to the discrimination that we've really structurally created in this country.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask Dr. Carroll if you can share some thoughts as you see, you know, sort of the context of the tragedies in Atlanta this week first, Dr. Carroll.
I'm saddened every time I hear about another event, that's a mass shooting event. And, you know, I think for me, it just highlights the need to really stand together and to denounce any kinds of acts of hatred, and really kind of band together and to see what unifies us more than what divides us. I think it can be difficult in a country this complex and, you know, to say, oh, this is an event that happened in a place that's geographically, you know, not local to me, or that it's the act of one kind of person acting alone. And it might seem like a stretch to connect it to other historical patterns, but people, they exist. They don't exist in vacuums. They exist
you know, we share the same society. And I think they're part of the fear and part of the concern is that, certain groups, even if they're on the fringe, have gotten emboldened and that there might be more societal tolerance for speaking certain things that maybe before were unsaid or for taking actions that before were not as tolerated. And I think that's part of what we're trying to do with the series.
So let me just talk a little bit about the reality right now for Asian Americans. And Dr. Chen Christensen told WXXI, you said that you are essentially too scared to go out in public by yourself. You're accompanied by other people often, and that the comments from the former president have not only emboldened some Americans to be more open in their bigotry, but have stoked anxiety. Can you give me a sense for just how acute that is for some Asian Americans, and if you can talk about how it's hit you?
Yeah. So I actually was born shortly after Asian immigration to America was open once again in 1965. So I spent my early childhood part of an extreme minority, because at that point in time, you were basically looking at a handful of Asian Americans that were allowed to emigrate. And I think that a lot of the hostilities of right now actually bring up a lot of the childhood trauma that I experienced back then. But what happened at the beginning of COVID is that the entire nation was panicked. We were all stressed out, right? But because of this focus on Asian Americans, the attacks were happening in places like the grocery store, at Sam's Club, at Costco. It was from anyone, and you just didn't know where it would come from. So it actually makes negotiating everyday life difficult, because you don't know whether walking down the street or going into Wegmans or, just kind of going about your daily life will actually result in a confrontation. And the more accounts that I read and I hear, it's literally Asian Americans going about their everyday life and getting sucker punched or beaten or spat on or, verbally assaulted. And there is quite a bit of fear and anxiety right now.
Have you experienced anything directly?
No, because I am too afraid to go out in public. And in the beginning, right, we were all kind of restricted and limited by the rules and the restrictions that we were under. But even as things have started to free up, I rarely actually leave my house by myself. I will go for doctor's appointments because I feel it's safe in a doctor's office, but I really do not want to negotiate the public by myself at this time.
Okay. And do friends of Asian descent feel largely the same as you? I mean, are you hearing different experiences?
Yeah, I'm actually having friends all over the nation actually message me and to actually thank me for speaking up, because a lot of them are too scared to, but also to express the same kind of anxiety that I'm feeling, to tell me that I'm not alone and that they are feeling the same way too.
Former Rochesterian and former Democrat and Chronicle journalist Mary Chow moved away from this community. She lives in New Jersey now, and she's still writing. She's writing for NorthJersey.com in their paper there. And in the Sunday paper, she wrote a column on Asian Americans living in the shadow of racism. And it was, her effort to sort of do a deep dive into some similar subjects. And she posted recently on social media about some of the hate mail she's gotten, Dr. Chen Christensen. One of the letters she posted, someone wrote to her and said, "This is a bogus bunch of crap, and your sole goal here is to pit people against each other. Stop pitting people against each other. This is so dishonest." And Mary just posted that and said, "I want people to see the kind of response we get, because this is not the only one." And it's, she got a lot of love and support from people who saw that kind of response coming her way. But to me, there's two things in that, and I'll ask you, Dr. Christensen, if you can respond to it. First of all, there is a doubt, and there's this, as I mentioned earlier, there's like this knee-jerk doubt that, oh, come on, that it can't be that bad, or it can't be happening that way, among people who've never experienced it. Usually the people who are saying that are white.
Yes.
And then there's this idea that, well, the only reason that things are bad is because when you talk about it this way, you are pitting people against each other, and that's needless. So can you address both of those points?
Well, so the first one about the, you know, kind of dismissal of Asian, anti-Asian discrimination actually comes from structural policy from the U.S. government. And that is, a lot of people look at the statistic that Asian Americans actually have a higher socioeconomic status than the other BIPOC groups, and BIPOC actually standing for Black, Indigenous, and people of color, and say, oh, well, then this group must not face discrimination. Well, we have to look at the immigration patterns that kind of are responsible for that socioeconomic status. And that is, it's very simple, that America really had a lack of scientists, technologists, engineers, mathematicians in the 60s. The Immigration Act of 1965 heavily recruited from East Asia and poached the talent of the 1%, the top, you know, the top students at every college were actually poached to America, basically saying, if you're accepted to a science and technology, a STEM program in America, and you go to graduate school here, and then you work for us, you may immigrate, right? And so even with that happening, right, so this poaching talent, but after coming here, then realizing that many of these Asian American STEM people actually then face discrimination in their own fields. But this whole socioeconomic stack actually tied to the education level of the people who were first allowed to immigrate when immigration from Asia opened up. Because Americans are so capitalist, they look at that number, that financial number, and go, oh, well, Asians must not face discrimination, without realizing that it was actually intentionally manipulated so that Asians who came over here were already extremely highly educated. So that's part of the picture of the doubt, because it is hard to untangle identity from capitalism in the United States.
And when someone says, you know, hey, journalists are just pitting people against each other when they talk about this. I don't know immediately how to respond to that. How should we respond to that, Natasha?
Well, I am a critical race theorist, which, you know, was highlighted last fall when I was actually then referred to as a very dangerous category of people. But critical race theory is actually very, very simple. It's basically saying that the U.S. government actually was founded, the United States was founded from the brutal enslavement and exploitation of labor of kidnapped Africans to the United States. If that is the basic foundation of the United States, and it is actually written into our laws and our policies, then fundamentally we need to examine how America has treated each group coming to the United States after, you know, the WASP population.
Okay, and so I'm glad you bring this up, just because if listeners are confused or they're hearing, you know, campfire stories about why they should be scared of critical race theory, as you know, in some quarters they are. Is there ultimately a goal of critical race theory?
Yes, it's basically to say that when we look at how the U.S. exploited labor structurally, the way that they wrote laws, the way that they formed immigration policies, what they essentially did was bring every single BIPOC group that was not already indigenous to the area, and they actually took some of the groups that were indigenous to the area, exploited them for labor, and then scapegoated them for the social problems of the greater U.S. society. So when you look at the struggle that Black Americans are facing right now, and that Asian Americans are facing now, and that Muslim Americans are facing, and that Latinx Americans are facing, then you actually see it's the exact same struggle. We are not pitting anyone against each other, but basically saying that we need to examine how our country was formed and how we operate and function.
Yeah, and then it's a question of what we do with that information, because I spoke with a listener of this program last weekend who told me, you can't go back. You can't go back in time. We're not living in the 1600s or 1700s or 1800s. We're living in the now, and you know, you can't fix all of that with a magic wand, because all of that is terrible, and it should not have happened that way, but it did. But it's 2021. You can't go back. What are we supposed to do with that? That was the message that he sent to me. How would you answer that?
That we don't exist in a vacuum, that we don't need a time travel to the past to preemptively, you know, undo what has already been done. Instead, as a nation, and this is like everybody, white, black, Asian American, just the entire nation needs to work together to dismantle this system. We're all involved in it, and it's not like we're saying that we're going to snap a finger and suddenly everything will be okay. But to be aware, to understand that there are fundamental differences between these groups, that it isn't a situation where everyone then is given the equal access to resources and opportunities as everyone else.
Okay. Christina Lee, how do you feel about that pursuit of study and that with that framework? What do you think?
About the framework that Dr. Christensen set up?
Yeah, yeah. Well, in critical race theory, yep.
Yeah, no, I am certainly a student and a believer of critical race theory. I think one of the things I did want to note is that you asked Dr. Christensen about her feeling of unsafety, but, mm-hmm. you know, some of the other sort of discrimination that many people feel in this country come in the form of microaggressions. So I think just the way that you set up that question, like when people push back on you, like, aren't we just separating people by bringing up conversations like this and putting it in the context of race? You know, some of those microaggressions are very difficult to notice. You know, some of our most well-meaning friends might ask or say things to us that are well-meaning, but perhaps setting up ideas of stereotypes that they may not even be aware of in terms of, you know, our understanding of the English language, perhaps, or if our skin is not dark, you know, that we can easily sort of move and fit into the majority of the, you know, population here in the U.S. So I think that's just another perspective that you know, that we consider. It's something I think is sometimes even harder to discern, because it is often comes from a perhaps well-meaning or trying to understand the other. But in doing so, like, these microaggressions just set up another level of othering. Mm-hmm. Americans who are in this country.
Yeah, and
I don't know if that answers.
Absolutely. And I'll turn to Dr. Isara to build on that point, Dr. Carroll, I should say. And you know, Dr. Carroll, on the subject of how we would even define microaggressions, it seems to me that when you have a president who continues to say China virus, in a way that is mocking, derisive, or even sort of stoking anger about it, again, different than actually trying to scientifically ascertain where different strains are moving. That doesn't even seem to be a micro. I mean, that's like a macro aggression because of what we overtly saw. And what's tough for me, I would say, Dr. Carroll, is I just would like people to be a little bit more intellectually forthright about it. That if you're going to call it that, be honest about why you're doing that, that there are functional reasons to use certain terms scientifically as we track a pandemic. And then there's that, which is entirely apart from any, you know, any sort of pursuit of understanding about it. But I don't even feel like we can have a conversation sometimes. It is very frustrating as a talk show host, I will say, Dr. Carroll, who doesn't seek to sort of choose sides, so to speak, politically. But it feels different now in this moment than it has ever felt in my career as a journalist. And I wonder if that seems justified to you.
Yeah, I feel for you in the position that you are in, you know, as you were talking about the reactions that you've had and other journalists have had, it makes me think about some of the experiences I have in the classroom, because when you bring up social injustices and inequities, you know, you have students who say, I didn't do that. That wasn't my generation. Mm-hmm. That's not me. I don't believe that. You know, so the conversations make people feel awkward. They get people defensive because they're afraid that you're going to lay blame. But I think even more importantly, at least I think in the past 5 years, because I feel like students have changed in my time teaching, I'm finding that more and more it's like there's a weariness, like, yes, it's horrible, it's terrible, I don't know what to do about it. And what I find to be a challenge is, A, that what we think of as facts has become more subjective, in that I teach courses that talk about displacement and refugees, and I've had students say, this could never happen. This is like a human rights atrocity. This could never happen. I don't believe this. And at that time, we were talking about the Pol Pot regime in Cambodia and the genocide that occurred there. And they're saying, this would never happen. I don't believe this. And so I think it's really difficult to say, well, my job is to provide you with information, with facts. And then, you know, if that makes you uncomfortable, ask yourself why, and where, you know, and where does that lead you next? But I think it's harder because we're now debating what is actual information and what is actually fact. And then to bring it to this topic, I feel like a lot of political rhetoric doesn't come out and kind of state a stereotype or state something that for some people would be so explicitly racist that they couldn't doubt it, right? But a lot of this rhetoric kind of insinuates or implies certain things that allows people to kind of fill in the stereotype themselves. And I think that's a dangerous place to be in, and particularly for journalists to kind of maneuver around that. Because so much is left to each individual listener to kind of fill in when they're listening to this kind of rhetoric.
Right. I mean, not everyone is explicitly racist, as, for example, Tucker Carlson has been of late, you know, saying that immigration makes the country more crowded and more dirty and less safe. And I mean, there's very obvious racism in a lot of what someone like Carlson has said recently, but I take the point that it's not always that overt, and it, you know, sort of tries to toe the line or have plausible deniability. But let me also just kind of explore a little bit more of what you do in a classroom when a student might say, as many other adults are saying, look, even if I can agree on this history of oppression, I didn't participate in it personally. I would never have. And I want us to be able to move forward and not, you know, some students will say, well, why are we obsessing over that? I didn't do that. It's not me. It's not my generation. What am I supposed to do with that? How do you navigate that conversation with a student?
It always comes down to a discussion of structural violence, and talking about how there can be certain policies and legislation or certain procedures that are in place, maybe at an institutional level, at an agency level. It seems neutral. It seems like it's treating everybody fairly, but it's actually disadvantaging a certain group of people. And because it doesn't have a clear author or a clear target, right? It obscures everything. It's easy to not notice how certain groups of people are being consistently disadvantaged over time. And so we have to talk about that. And I think that part of this dismantling of the system that was mentioned beforehand is really targeting certain processes, like maybe how money is allocated in a budget or a certain legislation that in theory, it's supposed to treat everybody the same, but in practice, right, it has a certain consequence for certain groups of people, and really kind of changing those policies or those practices. And so it's kind of getting comfortable with the discomfort of having to change the system. And it's also part of envisioning what the change might be. And that is the most difficult part, is changing a system that people have gotten very comfortable with. And what might that world look like if this didn't happen this way, or how can we imagine a different process for this?
In a moment, we're going to come back here after our only break, and I'll ask Karen Elam, the director of the Levine Center to End Hate at the Jewish Federation of Greater Rochester, to remind us of what sparked this conversation. There is a series coming up they'd love for you to be a part of and to know about, and we'll get right back to that after this, our only break of the hour. I'm Evan Dawson, Monday on The Next Connections. BMI is one of the criteria for being eligible for a COVID vaccine. But is BMI a good measure of our health? We talked to medical experts about BMI. In our second hour, a local organization called Curate is helping local restaurants during the pandemic, delivering culinary experiences right to your door. And we're going to get specific about how they're trying to help the community Monday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Karen Elam, director of the Levine Center to End Hate at the Jewish Federation of Greater Rochester. The series coming up, Asian Matters, standing with Rochester's Asian American communities. Can you remind our listeners what you'd like them to know about it?
Absolutely. So we have our first session of the series this Sunday at 5:30 p.m. via Zoom. It's a webinar. They can go to our website, which is endhateroc.org, and click on the link there to register. And we're also on social media, of course. And our first two speakers are Dr. Christensen and Dr. Carroll on this call, along with Christina Lee, who is our steering committee member and will be moderating.
Okay.
And Evan, I wonder if I could take just a moment while I have the floor.
Yeah.
Just to bring up a couple of points, I want to, first of all, thank Christina, Natasha, and Philippa so much for being on this call and for what you're sharing with us. And, you know, just to point out that why is the Levine Center to End Hate at the Jewish Federation of Greater Rochester interested in this work? And, you know, our mission is to engage our entire community in overcoming hate. And the way that we're going to do that, we say our three pillars are education, dialogue, and positive action. But really, ultimately, the only way we're going to get to this, and we acknowledge it's an audacious goal, but I think we all need to work on it, is to build the coalitions, the diverse coalitions, and to stand with each other. Jews have a history of oppression as other groups as well, right? And at the end of the day, we're motivated by our values. You know, one of the things that we have in our text says, do not stand idly by while your neighbor's blood is shed. And so quite literally, that happened on Tuesday. And it is incumbent upon us, we feel, in the Jewish community to address the injustices that are taking place all over our country and locally as well. So ultimately, you know, at the end of the day, what we see is that hate really lumps people into a featureless mass. And because they're featureless, they're less than human, and then they're otherized. And we want to elevate the humanity in all of us and address the violence that is perpetuated against people. So I just wanted to make sure to sort of get a chance to explain that, you know, really at the end of the day, our mission is to build the coalitions that need to take place to combat hate and ultimately strengthen our democracy. So thank you for allowing me just a moment to explain some of the background on what we're trying to do.
No, I certainly appreciate it. I think some listeners might assume that the Jewish Federation would be focused almost exclusively on anti-Semitism, which is, of course, an important focus. But I think I take the point and appreciate that explanation. And it tracks with some of what the AP was just reporting. And I'd like to ask our guests about this, about the fact that this week there has been maybe some appreciation for a solidarity movement, but also frustration that it took the mass shootings in Atlanta to lead to this. And let me read from the AP reporting on this. Quote, the hashtag Stop Asian Hate was a top trending topic on Twitter hours after the shootings on Tuesday evening. And the AP talked to Aisha Yacoub Mahmoud, who's the executive director of the Atlanta-based Asian American Advocacy Fund, which does political and advocacy work across the state of Georgia. And Aisha said, quote, I think the reason why people are feeling so hopeless is because Asian Americans have been ringing the bell on this issue for so long. We've already been raising the red flag, end quote. In other words, shouldn't have taken Tuesday night, but at least we're here now. And so sometimes what happens, and let me start with Pilippa, but I'll ask all of our guests to kind of weigh in on this. Sometimes what happens after any tragedy is you see focus, intense focus, for a short while. Sometimes, often now, driven by social media, like campaigns like this hashtag Stop Asian Hate. The question is, how lasting is that? How impactful is that? Will it make a difference? Will it change cultures and mindsets and actions? Or is it sort of a flavor of the social media moment? And how do you make sure it's not just that? Dr. Carroll, what do you think?
That's such an important question. Because I hear what you're saying, because as a migration scholar that's focused on the integration of refugees, there's always a crisis somewhere. There's always a group in need, and you can kind of feel fatigued, especially in this time of pandemic. And I think for myself, what I try to remind myself is that I'm, rather than responding to each crisis or kind of being overtaken with all the emotions I feel every time I see another injustice, is to really, really focus on this idea that I think got traction a couple years ago, of kind of making where you live, you know, kind of the place where you want to be, start from there and then work your way out, and just kind of being mindful of creating allyships and reaching out and listening to others and creating those bonds. I think that foundation is something that feels more enduring. It feels like something that could carry me through, and it feels like a better plan than just responding to each crisis. There's, you know, in the process of just being a part of the series, I've been connected to more and more people doing really wonderful things, offering workshops, providing services. I'm constantly gratified by how much I realize our local community here in Rochester does for each other. This is really a wonderful place to live, and I think that if we can build off of that and we can kind of work together, for me, that's kind of how I think about responding to this. I hope that answers your question.
Sure. And if you're seeing that around Rochester, are you confident that that is the direction we are heading as a country, or are you maybe a little bit more skeptical about that?
Gosh, this is a big country with a lot lots of different local communities everywhere that are very different. I wouldn't generalize, but I do have a lot of faith in this younger generation. I definitely see a shift in the students that I've been teaching over the years. I think just this newest generation grew up in a very different world than maybe prior decades. And so I do think there's less of a tolerance, and there's a greater ease in talking about these topics that maybe once were quite taboo. And so I do have hope from that, that even with the kind of the political climate, there still might be an undercurrent of a desire and a willingness to engage.
Let me ask our other guest to weigh in on that too. Christina Lee, what do you make of it when you see these kind of hashtags start to trend? Do you find yourself leaning toward the appreciation for a public response, or do you worry that it is going to be somewhat fleeting?
Well, you know, I all of us on this call, we're all educators in higher education. And so I think for me, you know, this is work that I try to do for the college. My department is global education, and traditionally global education is really looking at what's out there in the globe. It doesn't always turn its lens on what's happening domestically. And I think in the last several years, the push has really been to understand racial justice in the context of the migration and immigration of people, the movement of people around the world, and the globalization of products and political processes. And so actually, Dr. Christensen and I this year had a discussion with one of her classes and a class that we partnered with in the Dominican Republic. And you know, I think having those kinds of international conversations, also making sure that our education is connected to racial justice and social justice, I think, you know, I hope that we're not, this isn't just a trend. I think that it is imperative for all of us as citizens of this country, the diversity of this country, to continue to shed light on much of this, whether it has to do with hate or it has to do with connecting us together. So, you know, I think on a personal level, I'll just take my job and I'll continue to do the work and hopefully open the eyes of our students at our college and work with our faculty and staff. And I have, you know, we do great collaborations across the college and with many departments. And I hope we can continue to do that and that this won't be just, you know, just a trend.
Okay. And Professor Natasha Chen Christensen, what do you think?
Well, since the early 90s, I have been teaching about intersectionality, where you examine then what the commonalities of all these oppressed groups are. And using that kind of framework, what you understand is that working together, we actually have so many more similarities than differences. So when people say pitting groups against each other, I don't think that's the way we need to visualize it. I think we need to visualize it as everyone being able to come together. I've been teaching race relations for 25 years. A decade ago, I basically had to make the argument that there was still racism in America. Because at the time, most of my students said it is post-racial, there is no racism in America. Even though the events of these last, you know, 4 years have been pretty disturbing to most of America, there's an awareness now that was not here earlier, that it's very difficult to deny that America has a race issue now. And I actually am very, very hopeful because young students are coming into my classes with a wealth of knowledge that, you know, goes beyond what I even, you know, used to be able to cover with students 10 years ago.
Well, we got a few minutes left here, and Karen Elam is the director of the Levine Center to End Hate at the Jewish Federation of Greater Rochester. If you could, Karen, as we get ready to wrap the week here on Connections, mm-hmm. You know, you were making the point that this is an organization that is aimed at stopping hate of all forms and uniting a community, uniting the Greater Rochester community, and standing up together across different boundaries. To me, it kind of looks like, at least from my perspective, a lot of this work has been building for years thanks to interfaith partnerships, which I think are so important. This community seems mm-hmm. to be pretty rich with interfaith partnerships. And certainly there would have been a time in our history where interfaith efforts, interfaith organizations would have been anathema to the very notion of, you know, sort of what those faith groups were trying to do. How important do you think interfaith efforts have been in this community to building these kinds of movements?
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. I think they're absolutely foundational. I would say the interfaith and the interethnic work that that we engage in, certainly the work that we do at the Federation and have for years in our community relations department is about exactly that. So it is very foundational.
And is there a way, again, that our listeners, I should say, can take a look at the schedule of what you got coming up, make sure they're participating, and see everything so they're not caught off guard? They come around on Monday and they say, oh, I meant to do that, and here we are.
Right.
So remind people of how they can do all of that.
Absolutely. So go to our website, which is endhateroc.org. It's right on the front, the landing page, also on social media. And join us this Sunday for the first session of Asian Matters, standing with Rochester's Asian American communities, 5:30 p.m. this Sunday, Zoom webinar. We'll hope that people will join us. I will also say that if for any reason you can't join us, then please do register. We will have your email address. We will be sending out the recording of the program after it takes place.
Okay. And Dr. Christensen, I'm going to close with you. And I don't want to ask you sort of a trite question about what gives you hope, especially in a moment where there's so much hurt. But I do want to ask you if you are optimistic that some of the lessons you hope our community is learning that this country can learn in the long term.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That this is something that we actually need to start teaching our children. We need to start teaching at very early ages. We shouldn't wait until college to start tackling an issue that's so fundamental to the United States.
Well, I want to thank our guest, Natasha Chen Christensen. Dr. Chen Christensen is an associate professor of sociology at Monroe Community College. Natasha, thank you for your time and the expertise this hour.
Thank you, Evan.
Pilipa Isara Carroll. Dr. Carroll is an associate professor of in the Department of Anthropology at SUNY Brockport. Thank you for your time this hour.
Thank you. I'm a fan. I really appreciate the work you do as well.
Well, I appreciate that, and the whole team here does, I know. Christina Lee, Coordinator for Global Education at Monroe Community College. Thank you, Christina.
Thank you. Thank you for having this discussion.
And Karen Elam is the Director of the Levine Center for the Jewish Federation of Greater Rochester. Good luck to you with this series and with the work you're doing, Karen, and I know we will talk again soon.
Great. Thank you, Evan. Thanks so much for having us. And thank you to Megan for getting us on the program today. I appreciate it.
Thank you. And I appreciate calling out Megan, Rob. I'm the guy on the air. I get all the credit, but they're the real bones of this operation. Rob Braden is the engineer. Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. And listeners, I hope you are feeling love and peace this weekend. And we will talk Monday on Member-Supported Public Radio.